Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And we're trying to, we're not trying, we're actually delivering you all of the relevant content that created and was integral in the evolution of our government moving forward. And so as we kind of look at what we're providing you, right now we're providing you the notes, Madison's notes on the Constitutional Convention. There's going to be some points in time where you're actually going to see Madison's bias in his own notes. But, I mean, when you really read what he's saying, I mean, he puts a great check on his bias. But usually his bias comes through on his own opinions. And so, to me, it is so minor. I mean, I look at, you know, how I flame and how I make judgments and so forth in my own writing, and I go, well, you know, I've got a lot to learn from Madison, because I try to back out. I try to just stick to the facts. But nine times out of ten, when somebody's a parasite and all the evidence points to the fact that they're a parasite, the chances are I'm going to call them a parasite. But all of that being what it is, welcome back, Tammy, and welcome back, Sean. We are in the throes of the Constitutional Convention. We were just going to cover Mr. Sherman, and this is on June 6th. And so at this point in time, they were all kind of talking about apportionment and going back to, you know, who should choose the representatives in the lower house. And again, as I keep on saying, they're working in an evolutionary process as they cut their teeth, as they make these decisions, they look at what's taking form, and then they actually start criticizing it. And I will just say, you know, they put everything through the ringer to where by the time they realize, no, the state legislature should not be choosing the lower house. And then later on, the upper house became the representatives of the state legislature. The lower house was the representatives of the people, and the people chose them. But as we see here today, you know, or yesterday, and, you know, as they are still arguing, they're arguing against giving the people the ability to choose their own representatives. Much like England, the way the House of Commons and the way the House of Lords was set up. So anyway, any go-backs? Sean, do we have any go-backs?
We ended yesterday talking about the SAVE Act.
The SAVE Act. Yeah, so the SAVE Act is including this voting bill, correct? And so what else is a part of that? Is it all just voter integrity, voting laws, and so forth?
Voter, you have to prove that you are a citizen to register to vote, and you have to use a photo ID to actually cast your vote.
So I'm aware of all of the things that they're doing in creating election laws. Is there anything else that's a part of this?
I'm not sure.
Okay. Because I do know in... In 2021, the Democrats tried to create a law regarding elections. And, oh, guess what? The law that they were going to create was going to push all elections into paper ballot elections. Now we've got the Republicans trying to do, you know, this counter and stopping that. What's to say when all of a sudden the control shifts that it's not going to go likewise? Tammy, what do you think? You may be muted.
No, I didn't hear that last part. It cut out.
Oh, okay. So if you didn't hear me, when the Democrats proposed this in 2021, I was vehemently against this because they have, it is not in pursuant to the Constitution. They have no ability to create laws regarding elections other than declaring the time, place, and manner. Now, technically, you could determine that that manner, the method, is, you know, something that they could be involved in, but it's a very thin line. Now, backing out, when we look at allowing one political class, one political party to finally gain control of something that they've never done before, well, guess what? You have to be willing to accept the other side being able to do that, or am I wrong? What do you think?
Well, first of all, I would not. I don't understand what the problem would be with the paper ballots. I understand what you're saying, that they don't have the, they're not, that's not an enumerated responsibility,
right,
or
right,
authority,
yeah,
that they have.
Right. Right. So,
so I agree with what you're saying, that, okay, you know, what's to stop the Democrats from changing something that affects laws? If we let them usurp this power and,
yes,
overreach into this area where they don't have enumerated power, then what's to stop the Democrats from doing the same thing? I understand that.
Yeah. So what do you think, Tammy?
You, it should be an, okay, amendment. But at, like I said yesterday, there's a whole laundry list of things that the government is doing that is overreach at this time. If we can secure our elections to stop this fraud, I mean, I know that sounds crazy. I'd like to hear your rebuttal to, you've already overreached all of this. You might as well do some overreach that actually does some good.
Okay. So, Tammy, what do you think?
I mean, I can see his point. Like, you've already, I'm not really sure what to think because, you know, by law, they can't do it. But
right,
they're going to do it.
Right.
So,
right. So what should actually happen is that there should be an amendment that actually lays it out. And as a matter of fact, when you look at the standard of a U.S. citizen, there's so many things that are just so rotten in America. The fact that we have U.S. citizens who are able to vote but feel that they have the right to run an insurrection against the Constitution, something that they're legally obligated to support. In other words, if you cannot support the Constitution, you cannot be a citizen. So you want to start cleaning up the records. I would honestly say that law, or I should say that enumeration in the Constitution, and Uniform Act of Naturalization, and the act of defining the citizen, I believe Congress already has the ability to literally demand that the states actually start stripping people of their U.S. citizenship if they're actively seeking to overthrow, attack, undermine the U.S. Constitution, whether that be via protest. There's no constitutional right of protesting. But when they take positions against enforcement of the Constitution, removing invaders, then those people should be stripped of citizenship. And what would end up happening is, in the blue states, that would mean the legislature, the judges, the politicians would be stripped from office. They would be stripped of their citizenship.
That'd be awesome.
So technically, citizenship, citizenship was done by the states. The federal government was not involved in anything other than creating a uniform rule of naturalization and the thresholds and parameters of citizenship, such as a natural born citizen, and defining those things. And so, because that was a part of what they had to do when they stood up this new government, based on those terms and definitions provided in the ratification debates, the states expected them to do those things that they, you know, they stipulated that they were, this is what a citizen is, this, and so forth. So they did that. There's no reason why they can't actually create a law enforcing a person's obligation of their citizenship. Just because you're born a citizen doesn't give you a right to run an insurrection against the Constitution. You cannot,
that's a good point.
You cannot invoke the freedom of speech when it comes to your citizenship. Very specifically, when your speech actually encourages, you know, these state nationals, there's these state nationals or these sovereign citizens, all these people out there that are saying, you know, you need to surrender your citizenship, you don't have to pay taxes and all of that. Those people, instead of actually defending the Constitution, because the real problem that they're pointing to is that the Constitution has been attacked. We've got people sitting in office that are not complying. They're not doing their job. And the way out of this is demand full compliance with the Constitution. That's the center theme of this show. And therefore, if people were demanding full compliance with the Constitution and expecting that of their public servants and removing them as soon as they looked the other way, well, okay, so that would take care of all of what I would call the decent people. There are clearly Marxists out there that are coming out of our education system that should not have citizenship, period. And as a matter of fact, I believe that when a person is given citizenship, they need to take an oath to it. This natural-born citizen, that's nice, but I still believe that you need to understand that this is a legal obligation. And I'm not saying this lightly. Every state in the union is required to call upon the U.S. citizens of that state to take up arms, to basically use deadly force against enemies, foreign and domestic, who are attacking our Constitution, not attacking the president, not attacking the politics or the party or the office. I mean, it's one thing to call, you know, Biden, you know, a pig, you know, or whatever, right? I mean, that's speech. But when you actually say that the Constitution is illegitimate or the and you start going down this path of educating and getting people to rise up against the Constitution or rising up against the enforcement of legitimate constitutional laws, like repelling invaders, or states that are actually passing laws that make anything other than gold and silver coin the legal tender for the payment of debt. All of these things, when they're violations against the Constitution, we, as Madison states, we need to oppose every infraction and let the chips fall where they may. And I believe that if you've engaged in attacking an insurrection against the Constitution, not only should Section 3 apply if you're a public servant, you should also be stripped of your citizenship. And you have to prove that you can be trusted in supporting the Constitution. I don't care what your affiliations are. I don't care, you know, any of the demographics at all. All I care about is that you will stand shoulder to shoulder with the rest of us fighting against the enemies of the Constitution. That's it. If we unite on the Constitution and actually remove all of our enemies, then I think we've won this battle. And it's an easy battle to win when you place it into that context. So
I have a question.
Yeah, so let me close on the whole point of this. I believe that they have the authority within the Constitution in so many different ways to actually force these things down, to literally start going after, because Section 3 of the 14th Amendment is something that they're not even invoking in removing all of these public servants. And then actually sharpening the tool by basically saying, if you actually are supporting or running an insurrection out in the streets or involved in an organization that is calling for violating and attacking the Constitution, then you are no longer a citizen. And based on that crime and that criteria, we will deport you if you're that type of enemy. I mean, if you're just attending and you're out there, you kind of giving moral support. But if you're the planner, if you're the guy pulling the trigger, if you're in that kind of action mode, then you should be deported, period. What's your question?
What about Amendment 14, Section 5, Congress shall have power to enforce by appropriate legislation the provisions of this article?
Yes.
If you go back up to Section 2 about apportionment.
Uh-huh.
And how if they denied or how does it read?
Yeah, so
or
if.
Anyway,
so,
abridged.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're doing early ballots and you have all these fake elector people on your election rolls, your voter rolls,
uh-huh.
and you're letting illegals register to vote, isn't that abridging the citizens' right to vote?
So. If
because they're disenfranchising you by allowing someone who's not a citizen to vote. So if one non-citizen votes, that's one citizen vote that is disenfranchised.
Yeah, so I think what you're talking about is there is an effort of either election fraud, which is illegal, or voter fraud, also illegal. Abridging a person's ability to vote is denying them access, and you know, by using a tax, you know, the availability, you can't come into this polling place because if whatever, for whatever reason, that's an abridgment, taking away from somebody. But I understand what you're talking about by allowing this voting harvesting, this harvesting of votes, that right there, because what they've done, that technically the harvesting of votes is abridging a person's right to vote. Harvesting. In other words, when somebody gives up their vote and you vote for them, even though they have given it up and you voted, you have literally taken, because the reality is either you vote or you don't vote. If somebody comes along and votes for you, then you have abridged, because believe it or not, no answer is an answer in itself. Does that make sense? In other words, yes. When somebody asks you a question, yes or no, and they don't answer, well, the obvious answer is no. That's in the negative. And it's the same thing in voting. If a person chooses not to vote, then that right there is casting a vote. Therefore, when they harvest votes and say, we're going to vote for you, that is legally, that's both election fraud, that's probably voter fraud, and abridging the voters' rights. It's probably all three in one. Because one, you're going and getting the roles of finding people, getting their ballots, and then harvesting those ballots and then voting for them. So I think that's probably all three in one. So harvesting is, I can't believe how we got there as a nation, how there was nobody that stood up and said, are you kidding me? Do you understand what you're doing? And this only goes to show how the courts themselves are such a problem. Because when the courts basically say, that's good. Exercising democracy. Anyway, so my point on the SAVE Act is I'd rather see an amendment to the Constitution that dictates, you know, just like we made amendments to allow 18-year-olds to vote. I believe that based on where we are today, I think, how many states do you think it would take? And do you think we wouldn't get 38 states to actually stand up and say, yeah, we're going to ratify that amendment? And as a matter of fact, I'll bet you anything, if it's out there and you put that out there in next year, going into the 2028 election, it's kind of like the homosexual marriage election, how that's strategically done in an off-year election, if you know what I mean. Because most people don't vote in the off year. And so, because they just don't keep track of what's on the ballot, and they're just so unplugged politically, they just don't know. And so that's how bad things actually become laws or even amendments to state constitutions. So as we look at amending the Constitution, this could be a basically an all hands on deck of America demanding full accountability and full transparency in restoring our voting system that can never, ever be susceptible to fraud or corruption by allowing computers, men in the middle, technology, hacking, all of that type of stuff, which, one, costs way too much. I mean, I'm just amazed at how long it takes with the amount of money that they spent to make it efficient. It still takes weeks and weeks to get the outcome. So going back to precinct, voting in person, blah, 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 and basically creating an amendment of the voting process, boom, I think that would be done. Because undoing that would be impossible. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
It's kind of like undoing the Second Amendment cannot be done. We've been at this for 250 years since the Declaration of Independence, and, you know, 200 some years under the Constitution, and as much rhetoric and as much, you know, saber rattling that the left has produced over, you know, the evil of guns, they're not even close to getting 13 states to pass an amendment that would actually take away the person's right or undo the Second Amendment. I mean,
it shows you their indoctrination is not as powerful as they deem it to be.
Yeah, because it's one thing for the state to make laws in a vacuum and to create a state amendment to their state constitution, because that's just 50% plus one. And again, this all goes into strategy as to when do you have that election. If you want a low voter turnout so that you can make sure that you pad your side so that you can pass an amendment to the state constitution, then that's what you do at a state, because that's just mob rule. That's all got to change as well. As a matter of fact, you know, looking at Article 4, Section 3, Article 4, Section 4, my bad, that the United States guarantees to each state in this union a republican form of government. I would like to see Congress actually pass a law that requires that every state change its constitution to require, if not two-thirds, three-fourths of the counties of that state is required to ratify an amendment to the state constitution and take away the mob rule and the democracy. Because currently we're ruling ourselves with laws by the mob instead of through a republican form of government. Boom. Anyway, I mean, there's all sorts of things that I think that they, you know, having a constitutional president and a constitutionally focused federal government, but the problem is that they're the... they're the marauders of our liberty. At least they've been that. And the real question is still out. I mean, you know, is Trump fully a constitutional guy or not? And sadly, I just don't think he cares. I think that there's certain things that he wants to get right, but I'm not sure he cares at all. That's my two cents, because this is his second term, and he's, you know, got 1 year into this term. I'm still seeing chemtrails. We've got, you know, all these things that are still going on. We're still getting killed. They're still poisoning us. They're still, our pharmaceutical and medical system is still trying to kill us off. Our food system, same. Anyway,
Well, those things didn't get corrupting overnight.
Yeah, I know that. You know, I understand that.
There's a lot of good things going on with the Make America Healthy Again.
Yeah, I know. We're going into break. So with that, when we come back, we'll get back into content. All of these things are great speculations. We talk about these things when we talk about these ancillary things, but it's worth bringing up the SAVE Act, because we're going to watch this thing go, and it's probably going to pass, and it'll pass by the margin or by its teeth. Anyway, we'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so moving back into the mode of content, because I, you know, there's all of these things that are going to keep on percolating. And I hate, you know, I'd rather divorce those things from the content, because when we play these things down the road a year from now or what have you, and you're hearing us talk about the SAVE Act, it doesn't sink. But I get it, and I understand that people are gripped by what's oozing out of the legislatures across the land, from the federal to the states to the counties. And people are just in shock that what is happening in America. At least anybody that understands what is happening, they're in shock. And that's one of the reasons why there are so many people that are just absolutely giddy, because ignorance is bliss. I didn't make that up. I mean, it's so apropos. Ignorance is bliss. So I'm not asking you to get ignorant. I'm asking you to actually take time and read what we're reading so that you can actually see for yourself how these paradigms start off in this creation of the Constitution and how they move into a framework. They create a framework that is absolutely amazing. Anyway, so Tammy, if you would please, would you start us off with Mr. Sherman opining on this representation apportionment? And actually, in this particular opinion or this assertion, he really wants to get back to the fundamentals of government. So let's go ahead.
If it were in view to abolish the state government's, the elections ought to be by the people. If the state government are to be continued, it is necessary in order to preserve harmony between the national and state government that the elections to the former should be made by the latter. The right of participating in the national government would be sufficiently secured to the people by their election of the state legislatures. The objects of the Union, he thought, were few. One, that a defense against foreign danger. Two, against internal disputes and a resort to force. Three, treaties with foreign nations. Four, regulating foreign commerce and drawing revenue from it. These and perhaps a few lesser objects alone rendered a confederation of the states necessary. All other matters, civil and criminal, would be much better in the hands of the states. The people are more happy in small than large states. States may indeed be too small as Rhode Island, and thereby be too subject to faction. Some others were perhaps too large, the powers of government not being able to pervade them. He was for giving the general government power to legislate and execute within a defined province.
Okay, so let me give you a good example. I don't know if it's true or not, but I heard that it's now a federal offense if you harm a dog or a pet or an animal. And
it's not a job.
What's that? It's not a
I'm just laughing at that, because if that's a federal offense, then it's totally, but on the opposite end, it's totally okay to harm a baby and bite a wolf.
Yeah, I believe that, you know, I think I saw it in social media. It was just a meme. But I wouldn't doubt it because, look, right here, they're basically saying all other matters, civil and criminal, would be much better in the hands of the states. But yet, what criminal laws has the federal government not dove into and taken control of? See? This just gives you... Because when we start looking at, because I've shared with some, and I haven't gone into with the audience, the table of tyranny, and laying out, you know, what assumptions. Because even as I look at the table of tyranny, we look at assumptions of roles, responsibilities, powers, and properties, such as, you know, the Department of Agriculture, the Department of Interior, the Department of Transportation, the Department of, you know, Parks and I think it's Parks and Recreations. It's under the Department of Interior. But we start looking at all of these assumptions that are not within the Constitution and other violations. That's not even including all of the criminal laws that they've created, that they've assumed jurisdiction over. And when I see this, I go, you know, it was very clear to these men that the federal government would not, and we're going to get into this in the ratification debates in Virginia, where Madison basically says he doesn't think that, you know, over 90 some odd percentage, like 99% of all cases, crime and everything else, would never see the light of day in a federal court because it's just not within their jurisdiction. And because everybody was complaining that the federal courts were going to suck everything up. And he says, that can't be. Because their jurisdiction is limited to all things arising under this Constitution. So, you know, is, you know, abuse, you know, whether it be personal, domestic, animal, does that arise under the Constitution? Or drug use? On and on and on and on. And so, anyway, Colonel Mason. So, Sean, let's dive into Colonel Mason's little diatribe on this. Go ahead.
Under the existing Confederacy, Congress represents the states, not the people of the states. Their acts operate on the states, not on the individuals. The case will be changed in the new plan of government. The people will be represented. They ought, therefore, to choose the representatives. The requisites and actual representation are that representatives should sympathize with their constituents and should think as they think and feel as they feel, and that for these purposes should even be residents among them. Much, he said, had been alleged against Democratic elections. He admitted that much might be said, but it was to be considered that no government was free from imperfections and evils, and that improper elections in many instances were inseparable from Republican governments, but compare with these with the advantage of this form in favor of the rights of the people, in favor of human nature. He was persuaded there was a better chance for proper elections by the people if divided into large districts than by state legislatures. Paper money had been issued by the latter when the former were against it. Was it to be supposed that the state legislature then would not send to the national legislature patrons of such projects if the choice depended on them?
Okay, so what jumps out is that very first part where he basically says, because this is the change, right? Now, out of all of the things we've read, this was probably the most cogent argument regarding, you know, that the people should choose their representatives. So this takes a while. Mason was involved in the challenging of admitting states into the Union at a degraded sovereignty. Mason seems to be the guy that kind of see things, and I will say this, that in the Constitutional Convention, Mason takes the right position so many times that it's just impressive. But when he becomes, I hate to use the word Karen, but when he becomes this drama queen at the very end, saying, I'd rather cut off my right arm than sign that document because it doesn't have a Bill of Rights. Knowing all well, knowing fully that the powers delegated to it are the only things that the government can meddle with. Why would he even subscribe to a Bill of Rights? And he went down in flames in the Virginia ratification debates, trying to make a big deal out of this. And I'll say this because Tammy may have remembered me saying this, but Sean, you have not heard this before. When did and who authored the Bill of Rights for the state of Virginia? Do you know when that happened and who authored it, Sean?
No, sir.
Okay. George Mason. It was like 1783, 1784 during that first Constitutional Convention after the Articles of Confederation. They felt that they needed to have a Bill of Rights. And George Mason sold the idea and became the grand poobah of the Bill of Rights of Virginia. And there was a young, green behind the ears legislator that was given to him as a protege and a part of this little committee in creating the Bill of Rights, and his name was James Madison. And so they went off and created this beautiful Bill of Rights, and it was necessary because at the time, the Constitution for Virginia granted general rights or general powers. In other words, Virginia could do anything and everything they wanted under the sun. So the necessity of a Bill of Rights was absolutely needed. But they were denning all of these very specific powers and limiting them in scope so that the federal government could not get out of hand. And so anyway, George Mason, I think, was really more caught up with the opportunity of being able to be involved in the federal Bill of Rights because he took a lot of pride in the Virginia Bill of Rights. And so, to me, I think that's one of the reasons why he kind of became, you know, the mad dog. I mean, he just, you know, wouldn't give it up. And there were points in time, we'll get to it, there are points in time where he actually concedes, yes, you're right, you know, okay, you're right. But it doesn't mean that in the violations this can't go wrong. And the reality is, he just said it, when they start violating the Constitution, things do go wrong. They're going wrong because it's being violated. So anyway, George Mason, like I said, he was really the guy that helped center and get the things right in the Constitution. So as far as I see, and Madison was another one. Madison was so open to any of the ideas that as they broached him, and by the way, Madison was so well read due to the fact that as Jefferson was going through Europe, he was buying books that didn't exist in America, and he was sending those books back to his estate, Monticello, but he didn't have anybody he could trust, and I think postage was probably cheaper to send it to Marbury, or basically where, is it not Marbury? Where Madison's home was, Montpelier. And so he sent all the books to Madison. Well, guess what? Madison opened those boxes, and he read those books before he took them to Monticello. So he was probably the first well-read of all of these books that were coming, and Jefferson didn't have any time to read them because at that point in time, you know, he was thrust into the government, and just he didn't start reading his books until after he retired from presidency. But anyway, the point is here's Mason makes this very great point that the people need to elect their representatives. Now, Madison steps up and he kind of adds on to this, but let's see how he adds on. Go ahead, Tammy.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah,
please?
Sure. Go ahead.
At the very beginning, he says, under the existing Confederation, Congress represents the states, not the people
that
of
is,
the states.
That is correct.
And then he says the case will be changed in a new plan of government.
Yes.
But I thought you said that it was a compact between the states.
So it is a compact between the states. But the
how is it going to change with the new government?
Because they're, instead of having sole representation of the states themselves, they're going to actually have a bicameral legislative body, one that would be representing the issues of the people, and the other would be representing issues of the government, which would be the higher body. Because in this new body submitted by Madison, there was a lower chamber of Congress and an upper chamber of Congress. They called it the legislature at that point. But still, there was these, and they were working out the roles and responsibilities, but it became apparent that they were trying to create something that was very similar to Parliament, where there would be a bicameral legislative body, one for like the Commons and one for the House of Lords, where in here they didn't have royalty or aristocracy, so it would have apparently been the people. And that's kind of what they've been saying. And the whole point, I think Madison made at one point in time, he made the point, and I think he even brought this point up later in the ratification debates, that when you look at the people selecting the state legislature, that right there gives them the control even over the senators that the state legislature, because if the people aren't happy with the senators that they're choosing, they choose new state legislators. That was Madison's point all along, that it's not that the people don't have the ability to say, hey, you need to listen to us. And so anyway, and he points out that, yeah, in the states themselves, the states are, you know, the legislatures are elected by the people. And at this point, this is where he's saying that in the federal government, we need to let the people choose their representatives as well. That's what he's changing the paradigm from it being all appointed or starting from the state legislature. So again, I'm not sure if you remember the whole methodology of Congress, this federal legislative body. The lower house would be selected by the state legislatures. But keep in mind that the representatives or the apportionment is based on the population of people, not an equality of states. So when you look at it, the amount of people will flip the tide of who controls that lower chamber to the larger states, because the four or five larger states will probably, you know, control 70% of the representatives. Then the lower chamber elects the upper chamber. And if you've got a 70% advantage, what are the odds of getting a small state senator or upper chamber representative that would actually come from a small state? Almost none. So it was really creating a huge advantage for the larger states. This is why the smaller states said, no, we don't like this. We want to have our own representative in this government. So this, and if you look at the navigation pane, right here, we got June 6, 1787. If you scroll down, and we want to get down to, let's look at 14, 11, the 12th, the 13th, and then we get to the 14th, and you'll notice underneath the 14th, Mr. Patterson speaks, and then June 15th, is where we hear the New Jersey plan and then the Sherman plan. So we're just about a week away from Sherman basically making the compromise that the lower house will be selected by the people and that the upper house will be selected by the state legislatures. In other words, instead of having, you know, a representative government supposedly of the people, they're actually going to create representation of the sovereigns, recognizing the people being sovereign in one house and the states having their sovereignty in the Senate. So therefore, the representation and representing their constituents, that state government or the people of the district, now we're actually obtaining true representation in this bicameral mode. Does that make sense?
So yes, that makes sense. Okay, but I still don't understand where in the Constitution that the federal government will be acting on the people.
So when they declare
and how that changed, how that was going to change, and where the idea of that changing came from.
Easy. When Congress declares war, who are they acting upon? Who are they acting for? They're acting for the people. Because who has to fight that war? And if the people don't like the fact that Congress just declared war, then guess what?
But I thought the states organized the militia.
The states organized the militia, but it's Congress that declares war and then call force the militia, correct? Yeah, and so when you look at the roles and responsibilities, the other thing is the taxation. All bills requiring taxation or revenue must come from the lower house. In other words, it must come from the House of Representatives. It has to originate there. In other words, the Senate cannot drop a bill that is going to require any legislation, or I should say appropriation of money, the spending of money. If they got to write a check, it has to originate down at the House. So that's the rule. That's the way it's supposed to be, but they don't follow it anymore. But anyway, and that's because the people are the ones that really bear the brunt of taxation. Businesses don't. They just pass that on to their customer, right? And so, I mean, these guys understood. The reality was that when the federal government was making some decisions, even though they may be, you know, very limited, they do affect the people. War does affect the people. Taxation does affect the people. You could probably go through the different powers and so forth where, you know, the currency. I mean, overall, you know, the people are in some ways impacted by these different powers that have been, these very few powers that have been granted to the federal government. But the point is, in two very specific ones, taxation and war, that is a direct impact upon the people. I mean, it's one thing if, you know, if the Congress declared war, then they had to gird up their loins and then go off and fight the war itself. I mean, wouldn't that be great if the governors actually had to go fight the wars?
That would be exquisite.
And you would find some countries out there cheating, making everybody, you know, all the citizens a part of the government.
It'd be a cage match with Trump, Putin, Xi Jinping, you know.
Yeah. Anyway. All right. So, Tammy, let's pick up with Madison. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Madison, considered an election of one branch, at least of the legislature, by the people immediately as a clear principle of free government, and that this mode, under proper regulations, had the additional advantage of securing better representatives, as well as of avoiding too great an agency of the state government in the general one. He differed from the member from Connecticut, Mr. Sherman, and thinking the objects mentioned to be all the principal ones that require a national government. Those were certainly important and necessary objects, but he combined them with the necessity of providing more effectually for the security of private rights and the steady dispensation of justice. Interference with these were evils which had more perhaps than anything else produced this convention. Was it to be supposed that Republican liberty could long exist under the abuses of it practiced in some of the states? The gentleman, Mr. Sherman, has admitted that in a very small state, faction and oppression would prevail. It was to be inferred then that wherever these prevailed, the state was too small. Had they not prevailed in the largest as well as in the smallest, still less than in the smallest, and were not thence admonished to enlarge the sphere as far as the nature of government would admit. This was the only defense against the inconveniences of democracy consistent with the democratic form of government. All civilized societies will be divided into different sects, factions, and interests as they happen to consist of rich and poor, debtors and creditors, the landed, the manufacturing, the commercial interests, the inhabitants of this district or that district, the followers of this political leader or that political leader, the disciples of this religious sect or that religious sect. In all cases where the majority are united by common interest or passion, The rights of the minority are in danger. What motives are to restrain them? A prudent regard to the maximum that honesty is the best policy is found by experience to be as little regarded by bodies of men as by individuals. Respect for character is always diminished in proportion to the number among whom the blame or praise is to be divided. Conscience, the only remaining tie, is known to be inadequate in individuals. In large numbers, little is to be expected from it. Besides, religion itself may become a motive to persecution and oppression. These observations are verified by the histories of every country, ancient and modern. In Greece and Rome, the rich and poor, the creditors and debtors, as well as the patricians and plebeians, alternately oppressed each other with equal unmercifulness. What a source of oppression was the relation between the parent cities of Rome, Athens, and Carthage, and their respective provinces. The former possessing the power, and the latter being sufficiently distinguished to be separate objects of it. Why was America so justly apprehensive of parliamentary injustice? Because Great Britain had a separate interest, real or supposed, and if her authority had been admitted, could have pursued that interest at our expense. We have seen the mere distinction of color made in the most enlightened period of time, a ground of the most oppressive dominion ever exercised by man over man. What has been the source of those unjust laws complained of among ourselves? Has it not been the real or supposed interest of the majority of the major number? Debtors have defrauded their creditors. The landed interest has borne hard on the mercantile interest. The holders of one species of property have thrown a disproportion of taxes on the holders of another species. The lesson we are to draw from the whole is that where the majority are united by a common sentiment and have an opportunity, the rights of the minority party become insecure.
Okay, Tammy?
In a Republican...
So yep. Right there, we got less than a minute. Now, you've said okay. A mouthful already, or actually Madison has, and he's given us, a great history lesson.
He basically summed it up in that sentence right there.
Right. So I think that... the ideal is to try to create a free government that guards the liberties of the individuals, not the ruling class. And so that's never been done. That's never, other than I think with Moses and the rule of judges, where there was, probably the longest period of true justice for a society. But all that being said, anything, any points, Sean?
No, sir.
Okay, and anything else you want to add, Tammy? We've got 5 seconds left before we go into close. Okay, well, thank you both for being here. And so with that, we will be back again tomorrow. And actually, I think it's tomorrow. Yeah. Anyway. We will be back, and we will be diving into the last part of what Madison had to say here, and we'll be continuing on because, as I pointed out just a few minutes ago, we're going to be diving into the Sherman Plan. I'm Jerome Mobley with Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.